listening to the Top Music Guitar Podcast, the show for guitar teachers to learn about the craft of teaching great guitar lessons that students love. If you're looking to start or expand your studio and make guitar teaching your full-time dream job, you've come to the right place. Each week, you'll get to hear from some of the top guitar teachers from around the globe and get their best tips and experiences so you too can build your own dream studio. I'm your host, Michael, and I've founded one of the top guitar schools in Australia, written a best-selling curriculum, and I mentor guitar teachers. I'm excited to share my expertise with you and the wisdom of all the experts we interview. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Top Music Guitar Podcast. I'm your host, Michael, and today I've got a very special guest, a real treat for you, and that is Rob Hampton from Heartwood Studios and Greatest Gig. Rob, it's so fantastic to have you here on the Top Music Guitar Podcast.
Awesome. Great to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So I came across Rob a little while ago, and I've checked out some of his stuff. It's absolutely awesome and absolutely fantastic. And a few days ago, he popped up on Facebook and I sent him a friend's request and here we are. So he's very organized, very professional, gets straight to it, which I absolutely love. And he's an absolute wealth of knowledge and is doing some amazing things over in his studio, Heartwood Studios. And that's why, you know, we invited him here so he can share all the wonderful things that he's doing. So Rob, can you give our listeners a brief overview of your story so far and your journey from a solo teacher at Heartwood Studios, which understands in Redmond, Washington, near Seattle, to becoming, you know, one of the most in-demand guitar teachers in the Seattle area and all the online stuff you do?
Sure. I'll try to not be too long-winded. It's kind of hard to tell your story, but you know, I'm sure you want to get to the stuff that's really useful to your listeners. I'll try to be as helpful as I can. But yeah, so my story, I thought for most of my life I wanted to be a high school English teacher. So I kind of came to guitar teaching through this weird side door. And so I taught high school English for 3 years. I totally burned out. I was a terrible teacher. You know, like your worst guitar lesson where like, you know, the kid is like, you know, making faces at you or like in tears or something. Imagine that plus 29 other people. Like that's how I felt in my English classes.
I can imagine.
And so yeah, stuck it out for 3 years, proud of my endurance feat there, but then I quit and just kind of floundered about trying to figure out where I was headed next. And I joined a rock band because I was like in a band in college, and it's just one of many things that I returned to try to figure out what I was doing. And I was working as like Seattle's worst handyman at the time. And I was complaining to one of my bandmates about what a terrible job I was doing, like fixing someone's doggy door or something. And he suggested I try teaching guitar. He taught guitar. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I thought back to this time where I taught this cute girl how to like play a John Denver song in college. And I was like, that was really fun. And not just because it was a cute girl. It was like, I really thought I could enjoy that. And I had no idea if I could make any money at it, but it sounded better than being a terrible handyman. So he got me my first few students. And so, yeah, one of the most in-demand guitar teachers in the Seattle area. You know, I don't get many inquiries these days. And so in demand, like, I raise an eyebrow a little bit at that description, full disclosure. But I do hang on to my students really well, and I do still get a lot of referrals. And so how did I get here? I think one important piece was early on, I was getting some help building my website. This was in 2003. And, you know, this was like the Wild West days of the internet. And my buddy was like trying to help me with like branding 101. And he's like, what kind of guitar teacher do you want to be? And I'm like, I don't know. I want to be an awesome guitar teacher. He's like, do you want to be like primo? Like, if you have the money, you can afford Rob. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. And I was like, yeah, maybe I'll charge like some astronomical fee, like $80 an hour, you know? And I was just like picking money out of thin air. And my friend worked in the tech world, and so that probably didn't sound that impressive to him. So he was like, Rob, you should charge twice that much. You should teach, what did he say? You should teach Bill Gates kids. And I was like, oh, okay. And it just planted this little seed that maybe I should be just as excellent as I possibly could and charge top dollar for it. And that sounded like, you know, I wanted to have a family and I wanted to be able to travel a little bit. And I didn't want to live in squalor, even if I was doing a job I loved. So that sounded like a good plan. So that just kind of, that suggestion from my friend took me down a path of excellence. It probably wasn't the only thing that did, but I feel lucky that he planted that seed. And that meant that I was ready when I started getting inquiries from, you know, wealthy families who wanted the best guitar instruction possible for their kids, home visits that cost a lot of money, things like that.
Wonderful. And yeah, it's completely different to how most people go about trying to figure out their pricing. They go, what's everyone else charging? And what's the maximum I can get away with before it scares people off? Whereas you're very calculated and deliberate in going, okay, well, this is how much I want to make, or these are the students I want to go after, and going from there. And obviously that's panned out. And is that something you still do and cater to the higher end of the market?
Yes. I do have a few students who I teach at a reduced rate just because I want to teach them and they can't afford my high rates now. But yeah, the bulk of my students pay me a lot of money for about an hour's lesson. And then the home visits, I charge my hourly rate for travel time plus a little bit of extra prep time. So those are up to like, I don't know, $620 for an hour's lesson. So that not everyone pays that. That's like the top price I have. So yeah, that's the majority of my private teaching revenue is working for just like, it's just like I teach like 14 hours a week or so. People pay a lot of money to get the best music instruction money can buy. At least that's what I strive for.
Yeah. And I know some people listening to this are going to be going like, holy crap, $600 an hour. Like that's insane. You can't charge that much or you can't get away with that much, but obviously it's working for you and you've had a number of clients doing it. So for people who are scared of money or don't think they can charge that much, what sort of advice would you have for them, you know, in regards to that?
Oh, it's such a deep, complex topic, you know, helping other, I've done some work helping other music teachers set their rates and done a lot of soul searching myself. And, you know, people can just be kind of strange and neurotic about money. And I learned a lot about my own self, just figuring out my rate. You know, you do a lot of soul searching when you choose that number. On the one hand, I think it's important to choose a rate where you're not terrified to quote it to people. You need to really believe in it. But on the other hand, I think most music teachers grossly undercharge for their services. And there's a negative cycle where, you know, if you're not getting paid enough, it's hard to take care of yourself, hard to, you know, do the kind of professional development things that we need as artists and musicians to make yourself the best teacher you can possibly be. And so it's this like cycle of squalor that a lot of music teachers are in. And so I really encourage music teachers to almost across the board charge more than what they're charging and see if they can step up their game at the same time. Because at least my experience with music teachers is most of the teachers I've had, I felt like I was kind of their side job and, you know, their main gig was elsewhere. And I think if you really want to make this a livelihood, you have to give it your 100%. And I know that can be hard to do if you're also a dedicated artist. But, you know, like one thing I did early on is I started writing out my own charts and including things like chord diagrams and chord duration in my charts, which is something that you like can't find on Ultimate Guitar. So that was kind of an early step to you know, doing some extra work before the lesson to really make the students' time well spent when I was there.
Awesome. And I think one of the most important things, again, coming back to the money kind of point, is the fact that you said it set you on a path towards excellence. And you obviously charged a high price, but it wasn't without you putting in extra effort, providing additional value and being the best teacher you could be, and obviously striving to be, you know, better than average. So that's something definitely worth pointing out to anyone listening, to say, hey, determine what you're worth. And I totally agree. So many music teachers completely undervalue themselves. And I've said this on, you know, multiple episodes. People are going to be able to quote me along with this, but saying, you know, we invest 10,000 hours in getting good at our instrument, which is just as hard to do as becoming, you know, a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist. And then we invest another, you know, certain 1,000 hours into becoming a better teacher. So for some of us, we're doing, you know, two qualifications, two gigs, but we're still charging like, you know, really small minimum wage because we're worried about our student and what they're going to think. So if music teachers can get the confidence to realize that, hang on, you've put just as much effort into your music and your craft as all these other, you know, high paying fields, but we're not financially remunerated for it. So as long as you're providing value for your students, you know, there's people are happy to pay for value when they see it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, what are you doing differently? I know you've touched on a few things, and a lot of it is your personal excellence and, you know, striving to do better. But what are you doing differently at Heartwood Guitar Tuition that is so special and is getting these wonderful results and value for your students?
So I would say there is one like obvious, like visible thing I do. And then there's something that is subtle and people don't talk about very much, I think. So there are two facets. The one that's easy to describe and explain to people, I think, are my student concerts, which, you know, barring the occasional global apocalypse, I would have student concerts twice a year. And I've held them ever since about like 2006 or so. They started as little like open mic type things in a coffee shop with like a broken PA, you know, and like drunk people coming in off the street interrupting the shows. And eventually it evolved where I started getting other teachers on board to collaborate with, because I was teaching these students like, you know, these hair metal songs and AC/DC and stuff, and they just didn't sound that good on an acoustic guitar in front of a mic sitting on a stool, right? I wanted to hear them in their full glory, and my students did too. And so, you know, I had friends who were musicians and taught. And so I slowly accumulated this like group of us four guys, a drum teacher, another guitar teacher, and a bass teacher. And I teach guitar and kind of vocals, although my vocal teacher's head would spin if she heard me calling myself a voice coach. But you know, I help kids, you know, belt out like Imagine Dragons songs. So the four of us would bring our students together. This is what we do now. We bring our students together to hold this like this day of music, these three shows over the course of the day, just because that's how many students we have who want to participate. It's an epic day for us. And some of them are singing solo, you know, little five-year-old with their ukulele singing Mary Had a Little Lamb or something. But the majority of the students are like middle to high school age students playing in bands, playing rock songs that are a mix of students and faculty. And the kind of primo experience is playing with just the faculty, if you want to have like that, like rock star experience. And these student concerts, they're so magical for the students, and that they're really magical for us teachers too. They're like we all find ourselves like late at night sometimes just like combing through YouTube watching performances from these shows. Our students do it, we do it. We're so nostalgic about it since the pandemic, and we haven't been able to do it. Can't wait to do it again. They're these transformative experiences for everyone, for so many of our students and for us too. And I think it boils down to, I kind of, I made this realization after a while doing these student concerts that I should start focusing more on entertaining the audience instead of just like having an educational experience for our students, which seems kind of counterintuitive. I mean, we serve our students and our students pay us for these concerts. They pay to participate. But I realized that that's really what our students wanted. Our students, like more than anything, they want to play a legitimately good song for an appreciative crowd. What they don't want is like, you know, the typical student recital, like the stereotypical student recital experience of like, you know, a display of skill in front of like bored or stern judges, you know, like that's the stereotype of like the bad piano recital. They really want to entertain people. And so the more we could support them in really making their music sound good and giving the audience a good time, and you can tell if the audience is having a good time, right? Then that's what really creates the magic for our students. And once I get that student up there and they have a positive experience up on stage, man, they're just hooked. Most of my students have been with me for over a decade. And I think a lot of it has to do with their experiences in the student concerts. It motivates them to practice, gives them something to work toward, and it creates memories that will last them a lifetime. And so they stay hooked. And the parents of the young kids who do it, they're hooked too, because they see the impact it has on their kids and they have these beautiful videos that they can share with their friends and everything. So gets them really invested too. So yeah. Student concerts is one thing. Do you want to hear about the other thing or?
I think we'd love to hear about the other thing. Well, First, what we said was absolutely amazing and really important that you point out making the show entertaining for everyone there. And there's nothing worse than, you know, everyone getting a photo of their kid clapping and then, you know, all right, time to go. We've seen our kid. But if you can get the whole audience engaged and involved then and build that community around your school, that's a very big important thing as well. But yes, we definitely want to hear this second one.
Cool. Yeah, the other one is, you know, I was thinking about this and I'm like, you know, a lot of I think why my students stay with me and why they thrive, why they like me, just has to do with the way I talk to them. And it's hard to capture, it's hard to teach, but I remember earlier on, like in my classroom teaching days, I got very interested in just like how to listen to people. And I can't say I'm amazing at it. You know, my wife would probably say I'm not that great at it, but I try and it's important to me. And so like I read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People around the time where I was burning out teaching high school English. And I clung to this thing like, you know, like a piece of wood in the ocean. It was my life raft trying to get out of that difficult situation. And it has a section in it about communication. Mm-hmm. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. And like that simple principle is so valuable just for life, but especially for teachers. Seek first to understand, like learn what your student wants and learn what they like and what they don't like. And then they will be open to your influence. And then you can make a good plan for them that will really impact them. And so I hope that my students would say that they feel understood by me. And one routine that I learned from a teacher who trained me when I was studying education that I've carried on in my lessons is something I just do it with my younger students. I think my older students would find it corny, although, you know, I'm curious about them too, but with my younger students, I do this hill and valley check-in at the beginning of the lesson. I ask them, you know, right when we get on, I just ask them, you know, what's new? And I ask them, do you want to share a hill or a valley? And a hill is a good thing that's happened to them in the past week or day. And the valley is a bad thing that happened to them. And they get to choose. Sometimes they share both. And it's just this little way of kind of like taking their temperature at the beginning of the lesson. And over the course of weeks and months and years, you really get to know a person. beyond the lessons. And when you get to know your students deeply, it's so much easier to teach them. Plus, you feel connected to them. It's like these students feel like family now. And so it makes teaching incredibly rewarding when you have those kinds of personal relationships.
Yeah, most definitely. And yes, so many teachers get caught up in thinking that they're guitar teachers when actually, you know, you're there to be a friend, a coach, a mentor, and sometimes, you know, a therapist or a psychologist at times as well, particularly in, you know, in a private lessons, our students will often confide so much stuff in us. So being able to listen, build those relationships, it's hugely important. I think everyone, you know, could do really well to listen to what you've just said there. And definitely, if you haven't read the book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, definitely check it out.
Are you a fan too?
I am a fan. I think there's a lot of really good concepts in there. I think the 15-minute summary version is probably more my flavor because there's a lot of, I don't know, real. I remember reading as a 16-year-old, my dad said, you've got to read this book, Michael. And you know, maybe that helped me get on the path that I was. And I read it a couple of years later. I'm like, oh, you know, it's a bit dry compared to some of the other books, but really important wisdom in it.
Maybe your life wasn't as horrible as mine. You hadn't sunk low enough for the book to really be valuable. But you've had your own challenges. I listened to the podcast where you talked about your repetitive stress injury and being out of guitar for 3 years and everything. And to hear your story after that and you building your business, I know this interview is about me, but anyway, I just got to say it's amazing hearing the trajectory of your life so far. Really astounding. So I'm not surprised you read the book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I thank you for your comments and your feedback there. And to give you a bit of perspective, you know, I know what it's like to not be able to play guitar. And when that's the thing you want to do the most in the world, and that's, you know, your dreams of being a rock star and of, you know, being famous or just playing guitar for life, and then having that taken away from you and, you know, having 2 years of doctors saying they can't fix you and then finally having surgery, like it makes me really appreciate the fact that I can not just pick up a guitar and play for myself, but share that passion with other people. And that's a big part of, you know, what I do. And I'm just so grateful that I get to help all my students and also help the broader community of guitar teachers and guitar players through the Top Music podcast, through all the other things I'm doing. But no, I appreciate those words there, Rob. It really does mean a lot.
Yeah. And those things shape us. I mean, when you ask like what, you know, how did I build my business and everything? You know, I think about, you know, to what degree did all these things that I suffered through, not that I've had a particularly hard life, but we all have hard lives in our own ways. And, you know, a lot of those things really teach us a lot. So I think those 3 years of miserable classroom teaching really helped me appreciate this job, if nothing else. No matter how bad my guitar lessons are going, they're always a lot better than my classroom teaching. So they make me feel very grateful.
Yeah, 100%. Now, I'm curious, for those of, I saw another teacher post in a Facebook group the other day, like, you know, today I broke down in tears because this class just taught me that I had to teach was so terrible to me. Like my English class, I think she was an English teacher as well. She goes, I teach English and music, and my English class were like a bunch of little brats who just try and make me cry every week. And then my music class is, you know, where I connect with everyone. Do you think it was, were you not matched to the school? Was it the students who were particularly ratty or bad, or was it just the wrong combination of elements in that scenario? Because you obviously aren't having any trouble teaching guitar.
Yeah, I think I have come to realize that it was that my disposition is just not a good match with being a classroom teacher, that I have gifts that become challenges when I'm in a group of 30 squirrely teenagers who each have their own stormy internal lives. I love teenagers and I love kids. It's not like I didn't like them. But, you know, I'm a father of three young kids now, and that's given me a little perspective. Just dealing with three, a 7, 7, and 9-year-old and all their emotions and disparate needs and wants and everything, I find it overwhelming. I think I'm a very sensitive person. And I've, you know, I've learned to be tough over the years. And, you know, you can, very sensitive people can learn, can grow a thick skin. And do wonderful things in the world and be tough. But deep down, I'm a very sensitive person. And having 30 kids in the classroom where maybe a few of them aren't digging what I'm doing, one of them's really mad at me, one of them's uncle got shot last week and he's in mourning, but he still has to come to school. You know, all the stuff going on in just the everyday of your students' lives, I just found overwhelming. And so every day I felt like spread too thin and stressed out. And there were horror stories too of like kids throwing fireworks in my classroom one day.
And oh, well.
And laser pointers coming in. I worked at an inner city public school one of those years. But that wasn't the really bad stuff. The bad stuff was just every day feeling like I couldn't think straight because I was just so stressed with trying to deal with all these people. On the flip side, I knew I wanted to teach. I knew I loved teaching. And I thought maybe I could find something else. And when I stumbled into teaching guitar, now I was just working with one person, just one human being there in the room with me and silence around me, no distractions. And I could just totally focus on that one person. And so the sensitivity suddenly became the superpower where like, I loved getting to know them and you know, figuring out the nuances of getting them to play that G chord or, you know, getting them past the difficult part of the Jimmy Page solo and everything. It was a delight to work with one person. So thank goodness I pivoted instead of just running, you know, after being a total failure as a classroom teacher. I really just got lucky and stumbled into something that I was really good at.
Yeah. And I think it's great to, you know, just those last words that you said, you know, you stumbled into it, but you didn't give up. You went on and tried a different variation. And, you know, for some of the teachers listening here who are having a hard time in schools, then, you know, maybe you do have to make a switch to making your own business or finding a different avenue of educating people. And, you know, a lot of people really tried out online learning the last 2 years as well and gave up on that pretty quickly. So if it's something you're adamant that you want to do and you feel like it's your calling, just keep on trying to find, you know, the right fit for you. And I think it's great what you've done and said, Rob, where, yeah, maybe the 30 people on one isn't the right scenario for you. But when you did find the one-on-one teaching or the smaller groups, you were able to then, you know, be in your element and match your personality and disposition to the right context. And that's been all the difference in the world by the sounds of it. Awesome. Well, when I first came across you, I think it's because I saw a video of a really young kid. I must have been like 5 or 6 years old at the time playing Folsom Prison Blues. And it wasn't just the fact that he was playing it, but he was singing at the same time. So it was like the total package. It was just this, he was so cute. He was so adorable. It was extra funny when he sings like the part about shooting a guy. It was just so funny. And
I shot a man in Weno.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are at a computer or after this podcast, look it up. Like do you know the name of the video?
Oh, yeah. I think the title is like, it's a total like
clickbait title.
Yeah. 5-year-old plays Folsom Prison Blues.
So go to YouTube, type that one in, look at it. It's absolutely amazing stuff. But Rob, how are you able to get such amazing results with all these young students?
Well, that's a special video and it was a special performance. That was Wesley, who I still teach. He's going off to college next year. He's an incredible musician. Yeah, that was like a perfect storm of dimples and Elmer Fudd pronunciation of Weno and some good camera work at that student concert. And that video went viral. That was a strange couple of days. I had like Ellen's booking manager and Jimmy Kimmel contacting me, trying to get Wesley on their shows and stuff. That was a strange
wow.
Little flirtation with fame. And thankfully his parents kept cool heads and kept Wesley home. They didn't want to screw him up with all this spotlight and everything, but it was fun, you know, having that video touch so many people. And, I thought it was really sweet. So, how did Wesley get to that point? So I have this philosophy. It sounds like you have it too, from what I've heard of your interviews, that, you know, you find out what the students dreams are and tastes are, and then you try to, you know, help them meet those goals and honor those tastes. If the kid likes, you know, AC/DC, put an electric guitar in their hands, you know, don't give them a ukulele, even though the ukulele fits their body better and half-sized electric guitars can't play in tune. You know, give them the sound that they want. And so, and I believe in being a coach and not a drill sergeant, you know my way or the highway, no one curriculum for all students, although there is a place for that, I think, if you're like preparing serious students for, you know, being professional musicians, I think using a method is totally appropriate. But, you know, my students aren't like that. My young students come to me just wanting, or their parents wanting them to have a positive experience with music and plant that seed of love of making music and confidence that they can do it. And so Wesley was really into, like, you know, like Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash, this outlaw country music stuff. And I don't know why, his parents weren't necessarily that into it, but Wesley just felt this music deep in his soul, which I think is one of the indications that you've got like a young kid who's potentially really gifted in music, is if they have very focused, sometimes strange tastes. And so I didn't make anything of it at the time, though. I'm like, all right, kid likes Johnny Cash. Let's do Folsom Prison Blues. And it took a while to get there. But what I do with my young students, if they have any interest in singing, you know, I'm not a great singer, but I am a firm believer in everyone singing. And I encourage all my students to sing. I encourage guitar teachers, like, just find a way to sing okay. Like, take some music, some singing lessons, and learn how to sing on pitch. I don't believe in tone deafness. I know all the people who think they're tone deaf out there are rolling their eyes. There are probably a few of you, even if you're a guitar teacher. Some people think they can't sing on pitch. I don't think that exists. As long as you can speak in a normal speaking voice, you can sing on pitch. And I've gotten lots of people to sing on pitch who thought they were tone deaf. Anyway, but rant over. Going back to Wesley, I encourage my young students to sing. And I think the easiest way for a beginning guitarist to entertain people is to strum chords and sing for someone. It takes years and years, especially for a young person who are still like learning how to coordinate their fingers and everything. Like, I'm talking like, you know, 5 and 6 year olds. It takes so long to be able to play something impressive on the guitar. But, you know, if you can just like strum a couple chords, or in the case of the really young students, play a bass line on the 6th string and then sing over it, it doesn't take that long before you are completely adorable. And so, like with Wesley, I just like got his fingers on the soundboard and the thumbs chugging away, playing like quarter note root notes. And he was singing, you know, I hear that train a-coming, it's rolling round the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. Change the 4-chord anthem, Folsom Prison, you know. And they're just playing, he's playing root notes through the whole song and singing over it. And, you know, it still takes a while to learn, but that is such a lower, what is it called? Bar of entry? Whatever. Anyway, it's so much easier to learn than fretting chords. 5-year-olds cannot learn to fret chords. At least I haven't taught any who can fret chords at that age. At least not until they've worked for about a year. And I haven't worked with kids younger than like 4. So, yeah, teach them the bass line, and then they can sing over it, and then they can entertain people, and then you can get them on stage and people clap for them after their song, and they're hooked. They get so much positive feedback when they can sing and play the guitar for people that it can really boost their motivation. And it's hard teaching kids that young. Like, it's hard to motivate them. It's hard to keep them interested. And so that's been a really powerful way of getting them hooked. If I can get them to sing at all, that's the direction I go.
Yeah, awesome. And anyone listening to this, again, check out that video of Wesley. It's totally awesome. It's the most adorable thing you'll ever see. But it's great proof that you can do amazing things with your students if you believe and if you work at what does success look like for their level and redefine success. And, you know, every now and then you'll have parents saying, you know, they've been learning for a year, but they can't play a song yet. And while I think you should be able to play a song, if you're trying to teach them how it sounds like the record recorded by someone who's a professional musician with 10 years of experience before they ever, you know, anyone ever knew who they were, that's like trying to say, all right, well, Do you pull them out of basketball practice because they don't shoot as many goals as LeBron James? Or do you, can use Australian athletes, you know, are they as good as Gary Ablett? Do they kick as many goals? Are they as great a soccer player as Ronaldo? The answer is always no. But the parents, when it comes to sport or these kind of activities, they're very supportive because they don't draw the same comparisons. But when it comes to music, for whatever reason, we have to play a really, you know, a full song the exact same way it appears in the recording by the recording artists. But if we can reset that criteria to go, hey, at the age of 5 to 6 or, you know, all the way up to 10 years old, this is what success looks like. It's playing a simplified version of the song. It's working within the parameters of what are physically capable, you know, with the level of development they have, and then working to that capacity. And then as they get more experienced, as they get more mature, as they start to enjoy guitar and become more independent in their practice, that's when you, you know, zone in and make it a bit more, you know, technical or a bit more performance based or, you know, results based. But in the beginning, we just want to have them, playing and having fun and working to their level.
Absolutely. And I think most parents get that. I do think, you know, my style of teaching, my reputation kind of filters out parents who would have outsized expectations for, like, you know, their 5-year-old's ability to finger tap like Eddie Van Halen. But, you know, if they see the student enjoying music and getting positive feedback from other people for being able to play a song, that's usually all you need to win a parent over. You know, really what they don't want is to have to force their child to go to their guitar lesson every week and force them to practice. I can't say that all my young students practice. A lot of them don't, but they at least enjoy their lessons. And I think, you know, the worst thing is if the parents have to force their kid to do the lessons and it's just like this death march. So anything you can do to make the lessons more enjoyable for the students, I think is going to help you get the parents on board.
Most definitely. Now, a bit of a change of direction. Going back to what you said about driving to students' houses. Now, this is something that I remember doing when I started out. And when other guitar teachers ask me for coaching, generally what I say is get out of driving to people's houses as soon as possible, because generally it's people who prioritize convenience above anything else. And generally, as soon as you start running out of time and get people to come to you, these are the first people that go and you know, basically just replace you with someone else who's willing to drive to their house. But you've obviously done an outstanding job catering to the high end of the client. So can you tell us a bit more about, like, you know, the process of driving to people's house and this sort of facet of your business?
Sure. Yeah. So my kind of path to making this part of my business was, like, at the very beginning, when I first started teaching, I was living with an ex-con and a friend of mine who had, like, this enormous German Shepherd who would molt all over the tiny house we shared. So there was no way I was going to invite my new guitar students over to our little hovel. So I could only do home visits. You know, that was the only way I could see me getting off the ground. I suppose I could have rented a space, but I didn't really know if this was going to be my career, you know, so I was still dabbling. So I just did home visits. I charged $5 extra for the home visit. I think it was $40 an hour. When I said earlier that my buddy encouraged me to charge a lot of money, that was my plan for a little ways down the road, but I was too shy to ask for $80 an hour. That was like top end in the Seattle area. So I started at 40. And so I charged 45 to do a home visit. And within like the first month, I was like, man, $5 is not enough to cover the wear and tear on my car. Plus, this is a huge pain in the hiney. It's uncomfortable. You don't have a restroom nearby. What if it's during your lunchtime? So I after I got a lot more students, I was ranking well on Google for like Seattle guitar teacher for several years during this time. And I was able to build my ranks that way. This is the Wild West of Google. And I learned about search engine optimization and stuff and got this fire hose of students. And I just stopped doing home visits. But then I realized, you know, people still asked me if I could come to their home. And I'm like, you know, there's a need out there. Why don't I just set a price high enough for it to be worth it to me? And, you know, maybe someone will go for it, you know? So I just thought like, well, what would make it worth it? And I'm like, well, I could be teaching during all this time I'm sitting in the car. So I should charge my teaching rate for sitting in the car. That would help make it worth it. But it's also kind of a pain. Like I got to get all my materials together and get on the road. I don't have all my tools with me. And so it's a little stressful. And so I'll add on a little bit more to that. And so that's been my formula ever since, which is charge my hourly rate for all travel time plus about 20 minutes of extra prep time. And so that ends up being like double the cost of normal lessons. And, you know, partially because I kind of have branded myself as a premium guitar teacher who's really reliable and gets great results and everything and is really nice. And partially because I am lucky to live in a part of the world where people have a lot of money. There are a lot of, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, tech millionaires in this area who would love the convenience of someone coming to their house. I have gotten, I wouldn't say I've gotten a lot of people who've wanted home visits, but you know, every year or so I would get a family who would be willing to pay that rate. And because of the low attrition, I've tended to hold on to those students. They've become some of my most, you know, rewarding students to work with. I've become part of their families, you know, gone to their bar mitzvahs and birthdays and stuff. I teach the CEO of Nordstrom, and he's been so just kind and generous to my family. I got to work with the Bezos family for a long time and run Amazon.com and get to know their kids. And so it ended up both enabling me to work for some of the business leaders in this area, which was good for business, obviously. But also I got to make these personal connections, you know, just coming into someone's home, it's just a little more intimate and, you know, you get to know them personally better. And so it ended up being really rewarding. I don't know what to call it, spiritually or, you know, in my personal life. So I love those home visits. I still only do a couple a week, but they both put food in my kids' mouths. And they're also some of my most enjoyable time spent teaching.
Wonderful. I got to ask, what's Jeff Bezos's house like?
It's very, very large.
Well, as you'd imagine, but yeah, that's amazing. You get to make some of those awesome connections there. And I don't know, were those guys like, you know, giving you some business tips along the way as well? Was it like just, or I imagine it'd be awesome to hang out with some of those CEO types.
It is. It's inspirational, but you know, the business stuff that we do deal with is so different from what a CEO deals with that, the main thing I get out of it is inspiration, just watching how, you know, business leaders deal with their everyday crises. You know, when Eric Nordstrom had to lay off people during COVID, and I watched him do it with the same grace that he would use when, you know, he'd have to apologize and cancel a lesson or something, the same grace he treated me with, and just seemed to be so even keeled through it all. I'm like, okay, so that's how a leader works. And so, you know, when my children are not listening to me or whatever, I can kind of keep that person in the back of my head. They're good role models.
Excellent. Now, we are getting to the last couple of minutes of this podcast, and I just wanted to ask, because I know you've got so many projects that you work on, whether it's Greatest Gig or whether it's some of your teacher coaching and even, you know, guitar lessons. Is there anything that you're working on or promoting at the moment that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, you know, I spend most of my time helping guitar students on heartwoodguitar.com. It's a membership site. I have about 300 members, mostly beginners who want to learn how to strum and sing. And occasionally guitar teachers like to refer their students to my site because they know it's high quality content and they know I like to have a personal connection with the students. So they know my members are in good hands. And I'm actually, you know, when we get off this podcast, what I'm going to dive right back into is putting the finishing touches on this course I've been making for the past 3 years, Michael. It's been three years of making this Travis Pick Like a Pro course. It's this beginning course for Travis picking, and I'm immensely proud of it. And it's been painful waiting this long to get it out the door, and is going to be a huge celebration when I released it next week. I'm super excited about it. I don't know if music teachers are really interested in that. The main thing I like to help music teachers with is with their student concerts. And I have a great online course for helping make your student concerts awesome, which is kind of, you know, weird right now with COVID. Most teachers aren't doing student concerts, but on greatestgig.com, there's a course on there called Totally Awesome Recitals that I'm also very proud of and would love it if more teachers benefited from it.
Well, we just did our student concert this past Thursday, so like 4 or 5 days ago, and people were just so happy to finally be back up on stage after 2 years, and to see some of the parents that I hadn't actually seen for a couple of years as well. It was just an amazing experience. So I think anyone listening to this who has run concerts in the past or has never done one before, it's definitely the time to, you know, go out and do it. And even if you're nervous, we listened to Daryl Powers a couple of weeks ago in our first podcast, and he does really awesome gigs and showcases with his students. And he, one of the piece of advice he said is just do your first one. You know, you're going to fail at a few things. It's going to be a few stuff ups, but you learn and you do it again and again and again. You just get better at it. So definitely head to greatestgig.com and check out the stuff that Rob's got for you there for your recitals. And if you haven't done one, provided, you know, where you are in the world is opening back up and it's safe to do so, you should definitely look at doing one of those recitals or performances or student showcases. But definitely check out Rob's stuff.
If it costs too much, it's $300, and I know a lot of music teachers, you know, don't have that kind of cash to spend on themselves, or at least don't want to right now. And I also have an ebook that's a lot cheaper called Rob's Totally Awesome Guitar Teaching Handbook that I wrote back in 2009. And has a wealth of information about, you know, everything from setting your prices to, you know, teaching philosophy to helping unmotivated students, things like that.
Yeah, definitely check out all these kind of things. Where can we follow you, Rob?
You know, I am not on social media. I got off Facebook, and the best place to stay in touch is if you really want to stay in touch, you can just reach out and email me, rob@heartwoodguitar.com. I love getting emails from other music teachers. And you can get on my mailing list at Greatest Gig. If you're curious to see what I'm doing with other guitar students, you can get on my mailing list at Heartwood Guitar.
Sounds great. So guys, definitely check out Rob through the aforementioned channels and ways of reaching him there. Rob, last question for today. You've been a fantastic guest. I appreciate your time here. If you could impart one final piece of wisdom upon guitar players or music teachers listening to this podcast, what would that be?
So I love this question. So it got me thinking. I heard a song today by Jason Isbell called The Last of My Kind. And it hit me so hard, and it got me thinking about music teachers. That, let me just read the lyrics to you. Many's the time I've been, no, that's American Tune. Love that song too. Last of My Kind. I couldn't be happy in the city at night. You can't see the stars for the neon light. Sidewalks dirty and the river's worse. Underground trains all run in reverse. Nobody here can dance like me. Everybody's clapping on the one and the three. Am I the last of my kind? Am I the last of my kind? It is a sad and beautiful song. And it got me thinking about how music teachers, or at least musicians, how we are an endangered species. Most people don't even sing in this culture. You know, you go to a birthday party, and at least, you know, most of the birthday parties I go to, there's like one person singing, mom's singing, and everyone else is just kind of mumbling. And I think that is not a natural way for human beings to be. And music teachers have this, really this like sacred job right now of bringing music back into this culture. Music unites us, it heals us. The world is ragged right now, and it's our job to like knit it up through music. Music, you know, brings joy to people, and we need more joy. And so, you know, every musician and especially every music teacher I meet, I just have this overwhelming sense of gratitude that they're doing that. It's a noble job. Don't give up and support your fellow music teachers and musicians. I've never gotten this like competitiveness between music teachers. I know we're trying to run a business and everything, but we should be supporting and helping each other and cheer on every squeaky clarinet and off-key voice. Encourage other people around you to not make fun or look down at, you know, funky music, you know, bad singing, bad playing. Those are musicians trying to bloom, and the world needs more musicians. So right on for being a music teacher. We're doing good work.
Absolutely fantastic stuff there, Rob. And you know, what you said over the last 30 seconds, 60 seconds is truly inspirational. And we do, you know, as music teachers, we're more than just teachers. We are a vital and valuable member of society, whether we always get paid that way or not. But like you said, we can be agents for change. And particularly in Western cultures, we're far less musical than we used to be and far less musical than a lot of these other cultures. And that's something, you know, which is really quite sad. But Rob, I think you've shared some amazing stuff today. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast here and sharing all the wonderful wealth of knowledge that you know. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you, and I look forward to our next conversation. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure. Take care.
All right, guys. We'll see you in the next episode. Make sure you check out Rob from Greatest Gig and hit up Heartwood Studios. Some fantastic stuff there, and we'll see you guys in the next studio. If you enjoy this show and want to hear more of our work, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For links and resources mentioned in this episode, including a free ebook on how to find more guitar students, visit us at www.topmusic.co/guitar or check out the show notes. And lastly, thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.